It's 12 Enough, Season 10, Episode 3A, with your host, Jonathan Malone, and guest host, David Gregg. Twelve Enough is a podcast about Christian faith and culture in the modern age. Your host, Jonathan Malone, is the pastor of the First Baptist Church of East Greenwich, Rhode Island. David Gregg is the interim English language pastor of the North Shore Baptist Church in the lovely town of Chicago. This podcast is brought to you by 165 crisp $20 bills. That's how much this podcast is worth. 165 $20 bills. Or a little less. And we're back. We're now going to hear the deep conversation I had with David Gregg about beauty, aesthetics. We get philosophical, we get theological. It's a good conversation. David is a good friend. He's a good thinker, and I like the way, the generosity he brings to other people's ideas and thoughts, specifically mine. It's a kindness to it, and that I really do appreciate that. And I always enjoy the conversations I have with David. He pushes me to think of things very differently, and that's really good. I do want to add that the music from the last episode and this episode, the intro music and the outro music, they are done by my brother, Andrew Malone. He adds all these ukulele breakbeats, so this is ukulele and other stuff. If you want to find more of his music, you can find all that at andrewmalone.com. Thanks, Andrew. And here it is, the deep conversation I had with David Gregg. So I'm going to give the genesis of this topic of how we got here.
All right.
I read this book called The Theology of Jonathan Edwards, and it was big. And it was one of those books that after reading, I said, I don't want to just walk away from this. I want to do more with it, right? Because this was kind of in a, 700 plus pages, really good book, really thick. And it's something like, I want to do something more with this, right? And I said, who can I talk to about Jonathan Edwards that would actually be engaged and excited and interested in it? Part of the problem is that list is short. There's not a lot of people that get that excited. But I thought of you, David.
Well, thank you. Should I take that as a compliment?
Yeah, and especially because I knew a little bit about Edwards' view of aesthetics. But the chapter on it gave much more. You know, and I sent you those notes ahead of time. But, when we think of John, we won't be dwelling on Jonathan Edwards. Well, we'll be bouncing off his ideas. But usually people think of Edwards as sinner in the hands of an angry God. You know, that classic Puritan revival, First Great Awakening sermon.
Yep.
And he is much more than that. You know, so much more than that.
It may be that sermon is more than that, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
it's an amazing sermon.
It's
really written well. It really is. But every time I read, I'm like, holy cow, this is such good writing. Why can't I write this well? But that's my own issues. I'll take that to my therapist. So I know you're doing work on aesthetics.
Yeah.
Like, that's your thing.
That is my thing.
How do you spell aesthetics?
I spell A-E.
Uh-huh.
That's how I start.
That's it.
No, I mean, it's usually that's where the debate happens, right? So I do aesthetics.
Yeah,
right?
That's how I spell it.
Okay.
It's such a weird word.
It is a weird word.
Yeah. How do other people spell it? Just A and then TH?
No, just E. ESTH.
People spell aesthetics with an E?
With just an E.
That's blatantly wrong.
What? But tell the estheticians of the world that.
Well, they're studying aesthetics, not aesthetics. They're studying something totally different. I have no idea what that is. So you're doing work on aesthetics.
Yes.
And I'm not sure where this conversation's gonna go, but I
Yeah.
sent you these notes of the kind of summary of Jonathan Edwards' aesthetics. I am not an aesthetician by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just a humble theologian. So we'll see what happens here. One of the things I'm going to try to start it off. One of the things I found with Edwards, so he uses the word beauty because I don't think the word aesthetics had been invented yet.
Okay.
That was not true, but
It might be true. I don't know.
yeah, we haven't studied the etymology of aesthetics, nor will we. That's
Okay.
yeah, that's too much.
I mean, we could, I mean, yeah.
Come on. Just a
I mean, it comes from the
podcast.
Greek meaning feeling, right?
Yeah, that makes
Yeah.
sense.
Yeah. Like an anesthesia makes you not feel things.
Yeah, boy, could use more of
Also
that.
sometimes spelled without that weird A.
Is it?
Yeah.
Anyway,
Anyway.
yeah, Rylage is over. One of the things I for Edwards, knowledge of God is steeped in aesthetics, in experiencing beauty.
Yeah.
So that was one of the things I pulled out of the notes, the reading I did of that. And I wonder if that's a good place to even to start with, if you had thoughts about that, or if you've have found people going different places.
Well, I certainly do have thoughts about that, and I think that's true. I mean, I agree with that. I mean, so I come at the question from of such a different point of view in a lot of ways. And
Okay.
I've read lots of Calvinism, or
As
Calvin,
one should.
as one should. No, Calvin is wonderful, and I'm a huge fan of in many ways. But his sort of the basic metaphysical, worldview he's coming from is very different from mine in some ways.
Okay.
So, coming at it through, I do Whitehead, I do process theology and sort of process aesthetics.
Well, we'll allow it.
Thank you. But the point of, one strong point of commonality there is that for Whitehead and in the process framework too, beauty is the kind of one of the central categories. And things like virtue are derivative from beauty.
Interesting.
So for Edwards to start by, I mean, I forget how you framed it, but for Edwards to place beauty
Right.
at the center of his theology is something I'm very sympathetic to. And of course, it's all the devil is always in the definitions. What do you mean by beauty?
I was just going to ask that.
Well, so can I do a Calvin thing first?
Yeah, do Calvin first. What's
I'm
going
not.
on Calvin?
No, because for me, I mean that's in a sense what Calvin is also doing. Although all the people who are listening who actually know Calvin will, write in hopefully and tell you why I'm wrong in what I'm about to say, and well,
I
you
can't
should.
imagine that happening.
I can, but so Calvin talks about, the noetic effect of sin, right? The way sin doesn't just break our wills, but it breaks our reason.
Okay, yeah.
And the metaphor he uses for this in the Institutes early on is he talks about the world. Part of the problem is if the world is so good, why can't people save themselves by an appreciation of the goodness of the world? Just by seeing the glory of God that pervades the world. Also an idea that's very strong in process theology.
Right.
And the reason is because our brains are broken. We cannot reason correctly. But the metaphor he uses is that the world is like a theater of God's glory, but we have bad eyeglasses. Our
Okay.
spectacles don't work, and so we can't see the world. And that's what scripture is for Calvin, is the spectacles through which you can see the world aright.
Okay.
So the experience of justification is as much a repair of the reason as it is of the will. So when Edwards talks about, finally I can see the beauty of God, and that is what constitutes salvation. He's very Calvinistic in doing that.
Which is no
But
surprise
also,
for Edwards.
yeah, but also it, you know, I love the way it again sort of privileges something. I mean, I don't spend very much time thinking about moral philosophy, and I don't know much about it, and
Well, that explains a lot.
it does. It does. Because for me, sort of the question of right and wrong is just it feels like a shallower question to me than sort of the labyrinthine explorations we can go through when we think about what's beautiful and how is it beautiful and how is it eloquent to me. And in the light of that kind of exploration, questions of right and wrong take their place, find their order. You know, we were talking about lines before.
No, that's right. So if it seems though, like one could hear what you were saying, like, instead of looking at right and wrong, we look at what is beautiful and how is that beautiful to me. There's a danger of that becoming very individualistic and a subjectivity running rampant in the individualism. What's beautiful to me is what's beautiful to me. It may not be beautiful to you, but it's beautiful to me. And Edwards, he's going to be the guy I'm going to keep going to because I haven't read many other aestheticists. He's big on that we see the beauty of creation through our relation through our through the relationships. And the primary relationship being that with God. So that was almost a corrective to the individualistic what's beautiful to me, in some sense, what's beautiful to us. Now, I don't know if Edwards would go that far in saying what's beautiful to us, but that's where I'm going with it now, that I view it with God and with that kind of revelation through grace, let's say for now. And then we get to Calvin with I see now differently, or I see more clearly. Is that something when you talk about moving away from moral philosophy to aesthetics, do you bring in that understanding of the relationality in seeing beauty?
Let me puzzle through it a minute. So it's fundamental to process theology that we are always related. And in fact, it's not just that we have relationships, but we are the sum total of our relationships as integrated in a moment of experience and decision. So every moment we're deciding what we are in relationship to the past, our past self, all of the influences in the world around us. So we're, you know, and strictly speaking, in every single thing that has ever happened, we're in relationship with one way or another.
Fair, yeah.
And also, you know, dominating this relationship is our relationship with God, in ways. So certainly beauty can't be an isolated experience because there's no such thing as isolation.
I like that.
There's yeah, I mean there's only I mean in this way God literally is love. God is the fabric of our relationships, of us mattering to each other. And so the decision we make in any given moment is how will I order my experience of these, of what Whitehead called the vast welter of my experiences in this moment into a single self-expression into the future for the use of my future self and for the use of God and for the use of every other future self that is going to exist. So existence is fundamentally relational. And so the question of beauty is a question of how what beauty can I bequeath to others? And what beauty have I received from others? And what beauty can I pass on? So in that way I would definitely agree. But the question of individualism on a sort of a more of like a on a on a on a, on a sort of I mean it also brings up the question of taste, right? And how do we arbitrate between tastes which are not to be disputed, I'm told.
Like some people say Billy Joel is probably one of the greatest singer-songwriters ever.
I've heard that.
Yeah, it's absurd, but
And this is in some ways that's the fundamental sort of that's the unsolvable problem of aesthetics, maybe, in the way that the problem of evil is the unsolvable problem of classical theology.
Right.
That
We're not saying
that
Billy Joel is evil. Let's be clear about that.
I, yes, I'm certainly not prepared to say that.
Sorry, go ahead.
But there's always been a sense, right? There's always been a sense that both you will respond to works of art and experiences differently from how I will. And also, there is a kind of commonality or shared response that we are capable of. And we've always wanted to have it both ways, always understanding that there is a conflict there, or maybe even an irreconcilable conflict. So, like Kant, for example, sorry, I'm going to do a little bit of name dropping,
No,
but
but bring
you
up
know,
Kant, he's fine.
so Kant in the Third Critique that you know is very difficult to read and very difficult to understand, certainly by people smarter than me, and
Well,
it was very difficult for me to understand.
right, and you're smarter than I am, as we've already established. And but you write three critiques, by the third one you're going to start to get sloppy. I think that's what happened with Kant.
Well, it may well be, right? But so the third critique is the critique of the power of judgment,
Right.
and judgment is the faculty by which we appreciate beauty and the sublime.
Right.
Right. And so it's fundamentally aesthetic. And he makes this weird comment at least once, maybe more than once in the critique, that the faculty of judgment is sort of sovereign, that's my word, not his, is
Okay.
sort of the governing faculty of both the power of both practical reason and pure reason. So the two faculties that he went to the mat for in the first two critiques, by which he says you can sort of do all of this,
Right.
at the end of the day is governed by this power of judgment, he has a very difficult time explaining or defining. And sort of ends up saying something like, it is because he doesn't want to say it's objectively true, the way the power, the way pure and practical reason are,
Right.
because he understands, he knows enough about art to understand sort of the multiplicity of meaning capacities, right? So he ends up saying it's something like subjectively universal. And you sort of scratch your
Wow,
head saying,
yeah.
what can that possibly mean, subjectively universal?
Right.
And he says, well, it's a function of a new faculty called taste. And
Huh.
so that's his version of it. You know, Harold Bloom has this version of it where he distinguishes between the canon
Yep.
and the syllabus, right?
Right,
The
right.
syllabus is the thing that everyone needs to know to be educated. The
Right.
canon is kind of your personal trove of things that are most meaningful to you. And you know, Harold Bloom has his own kind of
Right, yeah, he's fun.
he is, right. I mean, so there's issues there. But he's trying to do the same thing. So I guess in my version, it would be something like, you know, everyone in the universe is inheriting everything that's always already happened, right? So in
Yeah.
a sense, we all have the same inheritance, but from very different points of view. Like what happened yesterday in Chicago is much more prominent in my experience than it is in yours.
Right.
And so, and yet I will share that sort of point of view with all of my neighbors and friends who live here in Chicago. So in any given experience, I'm always integrating all of these inheritances that are more or less public. Right? Some
Right.
things that are incredibly public, like the clip I heard on NPR from the Tillerson, you know, hearing
Right.
yesterday. Lots of people heard that. There's also, you know, the song I listened to this morning when I woke up that no one else in the universe maybe listened to this morning but me. I don't
Yeah,
know.
I didn't listen to it.
So it's a big claim, right? But
Yeah.
so I think that kind of more or less public maybe helps us to understand something about how we can be more be strive toward a common sense of experience, a common response
Right.
to a work of art, while still allowing for variations.
So here's a wondering. The a challenge seems to be in between this individual subjective analysis of whether or not something is beautiful, is good to according to taste, right? versus the universal. You know, how do we hold those in tension? Because, you know, like movies play on a sense of universal morality,
Yeah.
right? Right? They'll, you know, yeah, we'll watch something like 12 Years a Slave, and there isn't. And you know, you would say if someone starts clapping during one of the beatings of the slave and say, "Well, that's just beautiful. That's just great." He's like, "There is something fundamentally wrong with this individual."
Yeah.
Right? Right? So even if so if you know, putting aside moving away from moral philosophy and looking at aesthetics, we still say like this is an ugly moment. This is
Yes.
not a moment that has beauty in it.
Yeah.
Is there a way, you know, or is there a way for us to say to understand the universality of these claims of beauty that is void of the presence of God?
Oh no, certainly not.
Oh, you would say that, yeah. And I'm
Yeah.
that's what I'm wondering, because that's, you know, and you know, would that be a demonstration of the existence of God? We know God exists because we have shared revulsions as well as shared celebrations.
I think surely that's true. I mean, I would want to be, even with that kind of, I think that's a great example. But even with that example, I'd want to be a little careful to wonder whether, what was that person's reaction rooted in? I mean, was that person's reaction rooted in a sense that finally, at long last, someone is showing on screen the thing that is at the center
Right.
of, maybe their personal family history or a shared history of all of us as Americans that was at the center of this shared history of slavery that we never talk about. Finally, someone is showing it.
You want to
Yay.
give that person the benefit of the doubt.
Well, I want to try. I always want
Because,
to try, right?
well, which is telling because it says that to be able to celebrate something so horrific, there is so repulsive that we can't imagine someone who is a human being getting to that place. How could you see that as beautiful?
Right.
That's, I mean, that's, and that's fascinating.
And then you celebrate the eloquence of this movie that was finally allowed to show us something, finally able to show us something that has heretofore been literally unseeable, in at least contemporary culture.
But then to go to that next step and to say, and in these moments, in these shared moments, we see the presence or we see the working of God, because it's only in relationship with the divine can we be awakened, or can we have an appreciation towards the beauty or the horror of that moment?
Yeah, and I think it goes even deeper than that. I
Oh,
mean,
good.
there is no such thing as beauty without God. I mean, in one way, it was sort of a cheap one-liner I like to use is sort of objective beauty is God's subjective appreciation. So if God thinks something's beautiful, then it's really beautiful. And sort of our judgments and experiences of beauty are based in part on our intuitions of what God has found in that moment to appreciate.
So that's, yeah, and as you know, yeah, Edwards, you would say, like, in the realm of the spirit is true beauty found, which I
Yeah, I
think is
think
similar
that's.
to what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, what I wouldn't want to do is separate the realm of the spirit from the world, the way I assume Edwards would probably ultimately want to do.
He had a real sense of imminency. The imminent nature of the spirit in
Yeah.
nature. So probably not as much as we think. I mean, but regardless, you want the realm of the spirit to be in the here and now.
Yeah, so our intuitive sense of the drive to beauty. So Whitehead called it the eros of the universe, God's desire. God's desire is the engine that drives the unfolding of creation, and God's desire is for beauty. And all of God's creatures, with whatever level of awareness they have, receive that drive and make it their own as part of the moment's choice for what this moment will mean. So this person who is cheering the beating of a slave, we compare that in our experience of the moment with God's love of beauty, love of life, love of, sort of greater harmony rather than greater violence. And that gives us some kind of basis for our reaction against this person's response.
Let me ask you this. Does God like Jackson Pollock?
Do
I
you know
mean,
my Jackson Pollock story? Have I ever told you my Jackson Pollock story?
No, please tell me a Jackson
I
Pollock story.
assume God likes Jackson Pollock. Why wouldn't he?
I know.
So, I mean, most of the, I have to, I mean, so my Jackson Pollock story, right? Most of the great spiritual experiences of my life have been either in the context of nature or in the context of artistic experiences. Almost never in the context of religion. Maybe there's a couple. There's a couple sermons I've heard in my life that have turned me on. So I'm in DC one day and I.
Just for folks' note, David Gregg is an ordained minister among the United American Baptist Churches USA. But go
It's true.
ahead.
It's true. Well, I have to listen to my own sermons every week, so this is
Oh,
what
right.
apparently spiritual
There's the
experience,
problem.
perhaps. So I'm in D.C. with some time to kill, so I go to the National Gallery,
Oh,
and
yeah.
I go downstairs and
Yep.
around the corner, and there's this giant Jackson Pollock painting
I know
there.
that painting.
And I said, "Well, that's just a big fat mess. What the hell is that doing in my National Gallery?"
Right, because you pay taxes.
I pay
That's
taxes.
your gallery.
Now, I don't know if the Smithsonian gets taxes. I don't understand the funding model entirely,
I don't
but
know, but we can assume that part of our tax dollars goes towards those that art.
my National Gallery, right? And this is a big fat mess. So I decide I'm going to stand there and stare at this thing till I get it.
Wow.
I know. And it was like a half an hour. And finally something clicked,
Oh,
right?
nice.
And it had to do with rhythm, right? It had to do with the
Oh.
rhythm painting, had to do with the layers of the painting, with the
Yeah.
invitation in the painting to look through to something deeper. It had to do with, the painting is mostly white and gray and black,
Right.
but these silly little splotches of outrageous color, the little teeny places,
Right.
yellow, blue, red, where are they and why are they there? And I began to feel, sort of my eye, the story, the physical story my eye was telling as it went back and forth across the canvas, as the unfolding of my experience of this painting and the way this painting was controlling my eyeballs, just
Wow.
in how it was put together.
So it was in the.
And
Go ahead, go ahead.
so in that moment, I feel like there's a presence. There's a presence in the canvas that is speaking to me, which is sort of at the heart of my sort of theory of what art does. It's arrogant for me to call it a theory, but sort of the way I write about what art does is
Right.
kind of rooted in that sense that there's something else present to me, speaking to me through the medium of this work of art.
Right. But
And I
it's.
only call that, and this all men have referred to as God, as Thomas Aquinas would say.
Right. So, I'm with you there because I've looked at that painting, that very one, multiple times because I love that spot quite a bit. And I could get how you could go to a place where you would say, and that was beautiful. And it's a beautiful painting, right? What about those works of art that aren't beautiful? You
So
know,
again, it depends on our definition of beauty,
right,
right?
so I'm thinking of this string quartet piece by George Crumb called Black Angels.
Know it well.
Oh, good, good. So
No,
if
don't you? We looked at the score in your basement
Oh,
one
that's
night.
right. Yeah, I have it here in this office.
Awesome.
Yeah, the
You should
score.
post a picture of that score if it doesn't violate copyright laws, because
I mean, this is
it's
such a
insane.
small.
Anyone who knows how to read music
It's
will see, look at
so,
this and
yeah.
see it's so insane.
It is insane. And so for the listeners, first, stop what you're doing right now, go online and listen to the very beginning of Black Angels by George Crumb. We'll wait. Okay, good. So you heard it. Yeah. I mean, it's the beginning is horrific, right? And I don't know if you remember. Yeah, it's just like this high-pitched squealing sound. I mean, it sounds like people screaming in pain. And it's very evocative to me. It pulls out an emotional response, right? And for me to listen to that demands a relationship. It's not like. I won't put down anything. It's something that you have to be deliberate to not respond, and even then you're responding, right? And in that sense, there's something good about it. That's why it's one of the reasons why I love this piece of music. I don't know if I would call it beautiful.
Fair enough. I mean, there's a way we can do this. We end up just quibbling over terminology.
Right.
But all of those things that you say about evoking a strong response, about feeling like there's a did you say presence? That's my word.
No,
But
but go ahead, use it. That's fine.
Emotional engagement. I mean, I think the word emotion is tricky. I would call it an engagement of feeling.
Okay. An affective engagement.
It's sort of, or intuitive is a word I use a lot.
Right.
A sense that there is a knowledge or a reality there that isn't merely theoretical or propositional,
Right.
right? There is a wholeness to the experience. So all of those things I would say are descriptors of beauty,
Right.
right?
Yeah,
I
so
have, well, I was going to say one of the things I think is most exciting about studying aesthetics at the tail end. Starting at the tail end of the 20th century, because I've
Right.
been trying to get this degree for a long time.
But now you
And
could say
into the
your studies span 2 centuries.
yes, they do. Into the 21st century is the 20th, the art, the monumental sort of classical, high Western art of the 20th century, at least, once and for all dispelled the notion that beauty means comeliness or prettiness, right?
Right,
You think
yeah.
of all of these, you think of the symphonies we've talked about, Shostakovich,
Oh, so good.
or Mahler, you think about,
Right.
which are just, grotesquely out of
Yeah,
shape
or
and,
even Beethoven. I mean, his stuff is there's power in a lot of his stuff.
absolutely,
Yeah, it's not this
absolutely.
past they're not all just these pastoral love, lovely songs.
Absolutely. Picasso, you look at Guernica,
Yeah.
and Pollock. I mean, powerful, powerful expressions of something profoundly true,
Right.
but not pretty.
Well, that I like that. Expressions of something profoundly true. I
Yeah, I.
think that's a key statement.
Well, thank you. I'm to have. I think I feel like I'd have to work hard to make that good, but I bet I
Okay.
could.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things I was thinking about even while talking about this, for Edwards, he said one of the places where you find beauty is in the communion of the saints.
Okay.
And because in saints, with the saints, you find a well-ordered spiritual character.
Yeah.
And so let me play this out a little bit. I think a well-ordered spiritual character will see wounds in the world. We'll see horrors being enacted. We'll see sin occurring.
Yeah.
And we'll have a response of revulsion.
Yes.
Because that's an appropriate response.
Yes, I mean, and you mean morally well ordered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, right. Not that, yeah, exactly. So in that response of revulsion, we see the appropriate response, and in that appropriate response, there's beauty. But
Sure.
it's yeah. So to hear something like Black Angels, or to look at these other, hear these powerful things, and to say this really pulls something, this evokes something in me, or it is pull, there's beauty in that response, but I think you're right. We've been freed from this idea that beauty has to be a Thomas Kinkade painting,
Right.
which is horrible. Let's just say.
I don't know. Is that the guy who did the Elvises on the Velvet?
No,
I'm
that
sorry.
he's
That
much
was
good.
mean.
That's much better than Kinkade does. He's known as the Master of Light.
Oh,
He
yeah?
does
I
all
thought that was
these.
Monet.
Monet is the Master of Light, but Kinkade, he does all these seascapes and lighthouses and puts a little verse of a psalm on the bottom.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, it's horrible. Just horrible.
And I ask about morally well ordered because it would have an analog in sort of formally well ordered or aesthetically well ordered. Part of, again, going back to rhythm,
Okay, yeah.
part of essential to any work of art is its formal, its form.
Okay.
And one of the things that this art of the 20th century did was destroy, was insist, I will say, insist that the form of a work of art match the subject matter that it is responding to. And so it can't be just sonata allegro form like Mozart used.
Right.
It has to be, I mean, Beethoven sort of famously kind of shatters that,
Right,
because
right.
he can't say what he wants to say in that. And I guess the other thing to say is, so Whitehead defines beauty as the maximization of unity and diversity. So the more diversities you're capable of unifying, the more beautiful it is. The more well unified it is, the more beautiful it is. And so you have both of those variables to play with. So in Black Angels, I mean, he writes that about the Vietnam War, right? Yeah, so one of the unities, one of the diversities he's trying to unify is how does a human being respond to the Vietnam War and all the video that we saw and all the pictures we saw and sort of the loss of innocence, if ever there was such, in an American self-consciousness. So how can you unify that diversity in a string quartet that sounds like, I mean, Bartok tried, right? I mean, the century's full of people trying to do this. There's a place in the Shostakovich Symphony, the five, I think, or seven, I forget which
Well,
one,
five and
where you
seven
can,
both are.
yeah, where you can hear the tanks coming down the, rolling down the road. And it's chilling and terrifying. So it's not beautiful, but it is the way he unified that experience into, a single expression.
So, to bring this to I don't want to make it practical because that's, we don't have to, but to at least bring it someone into the pews. There seems to be, part of what I hear here in this, is if that if we, as people of faith, aspire to experience or to be aware of beauty, it seems that we have to have a real sense of what's going on in the world.
Absolutely.
And really be in touch with what's going on in the world, in its in the multiplicity of events.
Both morally, historically, and also aesthetically. I mean, we're trained all week long according to aesthetic canons that are floating around in the world. And then when if we go into church and all we ever hear is hymns, I mean, I don't want to go too far down the road of the problem today is hymns, because it's not.
No, in fact, that's the solution.
But if we try to hold up sort of aesthetic forms that no longer fit our situation, it's going to be hard for us to be eloquent about the call of the gospel.
So in worship, should worship, I mean, this, I didn't think we'd be going here, but should worship be a moment when we try to bring in the unity and the diversity that kind of Whitehead was talking about?
Oh, it's embarrassing how little I think about worship. I mean, I think about worship plenty because I lead it every
Again, ordained American Baptist minister.
No, I lead it every week, but in terms of trying to bring these, what I study into my worship planning, I'm very nervous about that because way too often I think we trick ourselves into thinking our problem is a problem of sort of style or idiom. So if only we did, I mean, the whole sort of, oh, how many generations of churches split over whether or not they're going to have a praise band? As though that was the key to the salvation of the world, to the bringing to life of the reign of God. It's a means to that end, right? Calvin Edwards always talk about how God uses means, so of course we have means.
What people little is just a little known fact, Calvin did was against the praise band. Jonathan Edwards actually had one in his Northampton church, and that's what led to his being
The Great
fired.
Awakening.
Yeah, started the Great Awakening, and then they decided they didn't like the praise band, and he had to leave. So, sorry, go
Yeah, no,
ahead.
one of my favorite. Let me see if I can find it on my bookshelves here. So, this crazy theater theory guy, Antonin Artaud, wrote one book. He wrote a book called The Theater and Its Double, which kind of changed the evolution of the theater in Europe in the 20th century. And he has this one-liner in. At the in the beginning of his book, in the preface, and I always think that I want to get this. Like, I'm not sure I'm ever going to get a tattoo, but I wouldn't be terrible to have this tattooed on me, right? He said, he says, he's talking about sort of, and part of what he's reacting against is fourth wall realism, sort of the prettiness and the domesticity and the smallness that he saw there, and because he thinks the theater should be about life and about pain, he invents a his theory is the theater of pain, and he says at the very end of the preface of the book, he says, furthermore, when we speak the word life, it must be understood that we are not referring to life as we know it from the surface of fact. but to that fragile, fluctuating center which forms never reach. And if there is still one hellish, truly accursed thing in our time, it is our artistic dallying with forms, instead of being like victims burned at the stake, signaling through the flames. And I think that
that's a long tattoo, David.
It is. It's like a whole thigh's worth and then some. Plus, I would want to be kind of unobtrusive. So
right, yes.
Maybe I'd get one of those tattoos that comes with its own magnifying glass so you can read it.
Sorry, but you were going to unpack that quote for
well,
us.
Yeah, just to say that I think too often when we fret about worship, we're doing this artistic dallying with forms rather than thinking about how we want to be like victims burned at the stake, signaling through the flames. And then when we're signaling through the flames, that's the aesthetic. You know, that's the true art of our proclamation of the gospel. So for that reason, I'm not going to write, you know, my dissertation isn't going to give an answer to praise choruses or tézé.
The question will continue to go on.
Well, yes.
I would say though, it should be praise choruses and tézé and Black Angels.
Sure. Well, that's one out of three ain't bad, right? Well,
right, I know. But I mean, to say part of worship, I think there is a school of thought that says I go to worship to be filled, to feel good, to connect with God, and I want to leave there praising God.
Yes.
And I think we would say no. I mean, yes, but then and more.
Yes.
Like there, and not every Sunday, but there are some Sundays when you should leave worship feeling like, whoa, that was hard.
Yeah,
that was heavy.
Well, and because the worship service was an expression of what's really going on.
Yeah,
you know, and made its effort in the prayers as we prayed them, in the songs as we sang them, in the sermon as we shared it.
Right.
That makes an effort to integrate the vast welter of our experience in this moment of time.
So
I guess a couple of implications I would say aesthetically is there aren't any topics that are off limits then.
Yeah.
Because if they're in our hearts and in our lives, they've got to be in our worship, right? And I would say there are we need to be a lot braver about our forms, about and not just sort of music as we, you know, so here in this section, there's going to be a song of some sort, and maybe it will be, you know, John Rutter, and maybe it will be, you know, something crazy, or maybe it will be Miles Davis, but music, and it will last between 3 and 8 minutes.
But rather to know, give yourself more space.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know, that is the one I was about to say the one constant is change.
Don't be that guy. Don't be that guy.
Say it than that. I mean, one of the things that art teaches us every time, every generation, is that there is a new way to do this. There is a new way to break open this medium. You know, string quartet can do something different.
Right.
You know. And Beethoven's string quartet did something different from Haydn's, and Bartok's did something different from Beethoven's and Shostakovich's and George Crumb's.
I think if we were to say what is an ugly worship service, which I know is a hard word to use, but a worship service that's lacking the fullness of its potential in being beautiful, is one that has moments of dissonance with the experiences of the people in the world, with the reality of the people in the world, that we need to avoid dissonance and in God's presence in all of that.
Yes.
So the dissonance we feel is the dissonance that God has in response to the sin of the world, or the sin on our hearts. You know, I'll make it personal too. Like, I'll bring in the evangelical. Why not? Right?
Why not? Yeah.
But that's really hard.
It's really hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
It's so much easier just to pick three hymns, do a sermon, do a pastoral prayer, and call it a day.
Yeah, although, you know, you can go a long way down the road to beauty by picking the right three hymns, saying the right things in that pastoral prayer, doing a sermon that is actually poignant or penetrating or, you know, provocative.
Any other P words you want for the sermon?
No, I'm sorry. I try to avoid alliteration at all costs,
Well,
but
it's
I
too
was going
late.
to do it then.
It was an ugly
Yeah, no.
moment, David.
As you were asking that question, I flashed on that line from Eleanor Rigby, right? Eleanor Rigby died and was buried alone in the church as they walked from the grave.
Oh, right.
Nobody came. No one was. Nobody came, right? Father Mackenzie wiping his hands from the dirt as he walks from the grave. No one was saved. That's an ugly worship service,
Yeah.
right? That no one
Yeah.
showed up in their full humanity, that no one was changed.
Right. And even if not, so I'm gonna, I don't know if changed is what we need or what we always hope for. Of course, we are our faith is one of conversion, one of change, but there's also can be awareness. If I go to a worship service, well, so like the worship service after a tragedy, and people come to church looking
Right.
for something. I'm not looking to change people there. I'm looking for them to have an awareness of where is God in this moment of tragedy.
Right.
I mean, every worship service is going to be different,
Yeah.
hopefully, because life continues to change.
But if you succeed in helping them experience where God is in that tragedy, isn't that because isn't aren't you trying to do that in the attempt, in the hope that it will make a difference?
Oh, maybe, yeah.
And if it happens, isn't something different then? That hasn't something been changed? And something more
Right.
profound than just some transactional, let's all sign a petition.
Right. Yeah, I
Yeah.
don't know. I'd leave that in the hands of God.
Oh, good answer. That's very Jonathan Edwards of you.
All I can do is say, here's where I see God. Do you also see God there?
Yeah, pretty close to the heart of the Whiteheadian aesthetic, certainly, and I would say all art is this
Yeah.
striving for novelty, that something is different. And even if, I mean, one of the things that always comes up, well, what about the individual life and in the of an atom that is part of a stone somewhere?
Huh.
Is that, what kind of novelty is that experience capable of? And the answer is, well, not very much. But
Good.
at least it's novel in this way, that that moment 48,427,000,001 is one moment bigger than 48 billion whatever I said
Right.
and zero. That every new moment is a new thing.
Right.
And so even if it doesn't feel like, I mean, in some ways, if it doesn't feel like anything changed from last moment to this, that's a sign of something important. What have I missed?
Oh,
Or
good.
what am I ignoring? Or what did I fail to take account of?
Nice. All right,
Thank you.
so I'm going to wrap this up here for this. This is a great conversation. I had no idea we'd end up with worship, and yet we did it.
Yeah, we did.
We did. This is so for all you worship leaders out there, I hope you've listened carefully.
Well, in case I had any doubt as to how you felt about Praise Band.
Clearly, I mean, clearly both David and I are huge fans of the arts, broadly construed.
Yes.
Hopefully that's painfully obvious. Folks, go out there and support the
Well,
arts. Go
yes,
ahead.
definitely. No, and you could do a piece of an aesthetic, Rylage, which I used to do. I don't do as much anymore because I'm bored of it. Is like 500 years ago, the church commissioned the great art,
Yeah.
right? Now we don't.
No. Yeah, our
The great
stuff is
composers don't work for us anymore. Neither, Paul McCartney and John Lennon, nor Olivia. I mean, nor
Elton John and Billy
Elton John,
Joel.
nor Billy Joel works for us.
I know, I know. So we got to do something about that.
Well,
But look
we got
for
to raise a lot of
beauty.
money.
Yeah, right. Well, that's part of the problem. Yeah, we need churches need to be more corrupt so that we have more money so that we can support the arts.
Well, this is God making beauty out of even the Medici,
Even the Medici. So look for, be aware of God's presence in the world, in the moment, in your life. And in that way, you're being aware of what is truly beautiful and let it happen. How about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a little passive, right?
Well, I'm giving you, this is going to be the last word now, David. Give a good closer here.
That you are a co-creator of the beauty that God
Oh,
is
you're
desiring from the
such a
world.
process theologian. Ah! All right, fine. We'll end it right there. I'm going to
It's
pause.
in your hands. I mean, beauty isn't something God is doing without you. God, beauty is something that God is doing through you.
Fine. Well, there you have it, folks. Jonathan Edwards, Whitehead, who, I mean, Kant, what more do you want? This is a star-studded lineup of great thinkers. And then David and I tried to keep up with them and maybe make it, but probably not. Anyways, think about how you see things as beauty, what's objective, subjective, where God is in that. And I think I really like that, looking at how we find God in that which we find or name or understand as wonderful, beautiful, etc. Thank you very much for listening. If you like to send an email about this show or any other shows, you can send those to 12enough@gmail.com. Go to Facebook page, like the show, and follow along to things that are happening. I also encourage you to go to iTunes, subscribe to the show, and leave a comment or rate the show. That always helps. And as always, thank you very much for listening. Twelve Enough is a podcast about Christian faith and culture in the modern age. Your hosts were Jonathan Malone, the pastor of the First Baptist Church of East Greenwich, Rhode Island, and David Gregg, the interim English language pastor of the North Shore Baptist Church in Chicago, Illinois. The thoughts, ideas, opinions, ruminations, moments of brilliance, moments of wondering, and moments when we just don't quite get it right do not reflect Jonathan Edwards or his kin, do not reflect Whitehead, do not reflect Immanuel Kant, do not reflect anyone else. They do not reflect the power of art or bad art, good art, whatever else. These are their own ideas. This is their podcast.